Coming up on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast.
The traditional perspective would point to a difference between a treatment and an initiation. Initiation being a sacrament on its own alongside whatever yoga is involved in that. And of course, I think that the clinical approach misses a lot of layers of what happens in an initiation, and that there's like a level of knowledge that doesn't carry through yet. I do think that Iboga and Ibogaine on its own can be transformative, and the sacraments of initiation and having that collision of worldviews can also be transformative, but it's not necessarily going to be the most helpful thing for a lot of people, depending on where they're at in their life and kind of what they're going through.
Welcome to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast, a weekly conversation series with leaders in psychedelic culture, designed for therapists, healers, retreat leaders, and passionate enthusiasts, presented by Maya and hosted by me, Eamon Armstrong. Welcome back to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. I am your host, Eamon Armstrong. Iboga, or its extraction Ibogaine, is one of the most powerful psychedelic healing plants known to man. Today, we are joined by Jonathan Dickinson of Seba Recovery, an integration coach and consultant for Iboga and Ibogaine healing. Our conversation begins with an overview of the plant and its unique value in treating addiction. We discuss Bwiti tradition in Gabon and Central Africa, where Iboga is used as an initiatory sacrament. Jonathan shares his work with Seba Recovery, which includes online Ibogaine aftercare. We conclude with the pros and cons of a clinical Ibogaine setting versus the traditional Iboga initiation, as well as general advice on integrating this powerful medicine. Jonathan is a recovery coach and consultant and has been working with Iboga and Ibogaine in both clinical and ceremonial contexts in Mexico, Canada, and Costa Rica since 2009. He has been part of hundreds of detox treatments and has also coached people through long-term microdosing protocols for everything from depression and anxiety to neurodegenerative disorders. He previously served as the director of the Global Ibogaine Therapy Alliance, during which time he led the development of the clinical guidelines for Ibogaine-assisted detoxification, a risk management guide that remains standard in the field. And now, here is Jonathan Dickinson.
It never feels like you really knew anything, or that you grow up. I don't think. I don't know. Maybe it does. Maybe some people feel like that, but I just feel more relaxed than I used to.
You know, was a bit off the cuff, but that's actually a really interesting starting place, or just a nice kind of preamble, is that accepting the fact that there isn't some sort of end point to our healing / emotional and spiritual growth is an interesting part of healing / emotional and spiritual growth, is the idea that we get calmer, we get more present, we're able to be more in service to others, we're able to be more connected to community, but there isn't some kind of threshold point where it's like, oh, if I just do 12 ayahuasca ceremonies, or if I just do the big bad Iboga initiation, then I'll have crossed this threshold and I can be what I perceive as a sort of healed and healthy human.
Yeah, sure. I mean, when I am talking with people going through Ibogaine, especially in recovery, I think sometimes, especially when we're looking at psychedelics, people are looking to these peak moments and almost like a kind of lightning bolt healing, or maybe being able to come out of it feeling great. And I think that what I've been able to witness in myself, and what's been a more accurate target, has just been having like slightly higher lows. It's not having higher peaks. It's just gradually increasing baseline. And so I didn't feel like it crashes hard for as long, and recover a little bit more quickly when I do. That's all.
Well, and that relates a lot to addiction itself, because addiction is so much about chasing those peak experiences, whether it's with an opiate or whether it's through certain compulsive behaviors, gambling, et cetera. This constant thrust towards these peaks, which of course, when you live that way, your lows are very low because you're so hyper-stimulated with the peaks. So this idea of slowly and gently raising the baseline as the type of healing is, I think, really important. And it's really important for those, particularly those who are looking to psychedelic healing because of addiction, to be wary of chasing peak experiences. Because as I was once told, and I love to share, is only Hanuman can leap from peak to peak. The rest of us, when we get a peak, have at least some valley then to cross. So I love that perspective that you have, and I think that it actually really underpins your work with Seba and the work that you've done in your own life. So it's a beautiful place to start as we welcome you, Jonathan, to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, and I'm just going to say out the gate that this is an important conversation for me personally. And as I think our listeners, if you've been listening to the show for a while, are aware, I actually had an initiation with Iboga 3 years ago. So even on our preliminary call, having a conversation about Iboga and this idea of initiation was extraordinarily impactful for me. And so I'm excited to go deeper on that today. However, since many of our listeners might not be acquainted with Iboga or Ibogaine, or may have just sort of heard it as a kind of exotic treatment for heroin addiction, I think maybe we should just start with what Iboga is, this sort of Mount Everest, or perhaps more appropriately, Mount Kilimanjaro of psychedelic medicine.
Sure. Well, I guess the technical definition, so Iboga is a perennial shrub. There's probably a couple of different like Latin names of plants that get called the common name Iboga, but the most common of those would be Tabernanthe Iboga. And it's endemic to the central west coast of Africa. So it's culturally most centered in Gabon, but you see it a little bit outside of Gabon as well, like in Cameroon, Angola, Congo. And so when I say culturally, that use goes back who knows how long, but we know it particularly through this cultural expression of the spiritual practice called Bwiti that's been around for, I don't know, at least 150 years since the Bantu population that lived on the coast of Gabon came in contact with the pygmies that lived in the jungles, the area, especially around like the colonial time. So, and since then, Bwiti has become this mix of African ritual with the use of Iboga. And it's certainly the main reason why we know about it. So it stimulates really powerful dreamlike states. Usually people need to rest their body for a good period of time while they're going through it. It's taxing physically, emotionally, spiritually to go through. It can be a somewhat challenging experience. People call it like you mentioned, this sort of high peak, like the Mount Everest of psychedelics. But I think it's not like perfectly that it's just more intense than other psychedelics. I think it's challenging in different ways than other kinds of psychedelic experiences. And so in the context of Bwiti, it's used, you know, Iboga is seen sort of as a sacrament. And within Bwiti, in that spiritual practice, it's also used in an initiatory rite. And so the initiation itself is also seen as another kind of sacrament. So outside of initiation, even within Bwiti, there might be other uses of it as well, medical treatments and things. So I think outside of Gabon, we start to see it being used either as Iboga in its raw form, or more commonly, the extract of Ibogaine, which is what more people know. And I think it is more commonly talked about in the terms of being a treatment, whether it's for a medical purpose, like helping with drug detox, or whether it's for some other kind of psychotherapeutic purpose. It sort of better reflects that original use as a treatment. So it's a little bit of a description anyways, what Iboga is.
You said that it's challenging in different ways than other psychedelics. How would you define those challenges? And perhaps you could share a little bit about what the experience of being on Iboga actually feels like as a patient or as a journeyer.
Sure. So I think it's useful if you have a reference point with other kind of psychedelic experiences to think about. I sometimes think about, I guess, LSD as maybe a good comparison because it's got the more of the contrast that I'm trying to point out. So with LSD, it often feels like your sense of self can become greatly expanded or changed. Like you can feel like you're connecting with things outside of you. Or even if, for example, you're looking at the wall and you're seeing things moving across it, maybe it feels like it's a projection, but you don't really get a strong sense of where your projection ends and the other and the rest of reality begins. Like you merge with the world around you. And so your sense of identification, like who you are, becomes bigger or changes. With Ibogaine, I almost feel like to some extent it's the opposite. Even with things that are very personal, like memories, I guess in the case of like memories from your childhood that come up, there's almost this sense of being able to step back into this vantage of just being like a witness and sort of seeing what's coming up is just passing away. And almost there's less of an identification with that, even if it feels sort of personal. So I think that's quite distinct from feeling like you're crawling out your eyeballs to feeling like you're sitting back and almost watching things pass in front of you. So that sense it leaves you with is you know where you are, you know more often like where your center is, where your body is, what's going on around you. Like if somebody comes in and speaks to you, you can respond to them. And it's almost like if there's a lot going on, it's often happening in this other world. So you're aware of this one and you're aware of your body. And then there's something else happening in this sort of dream state, dream space. So I think that sense of knowing where your center is through the experience, it's actually really, really useful. And I think it's one of the things that it kind of can show you and anchor you to. But I think it also, in some ways, in that way, maybe it makes it almost easier than other psychedelics. Like we don't see people having really strong emotional reactions to things that they're seeing or having a proverbial bad trip in the same way that you could hear about with mushrooms or LSD. Even when people are taking Ibogaine in the midst of a personal crisis, you know what I mean? So the challenge is different, but the challenging part about it might be that, well, for one, it's quite physical. It's also quite long. And so it can be quite taxing. It can be exhausting. So even the duration of it might look something like an LSD trip. It might be that the most intense part of it might relate in the sense that it's 8 to 10 hours, but the after effects can continue for quite a long time and be very pronounced for days. So it's a bit of a marathon. But I also think that's part of the reason why it's so beneficial, because it sort of gives us something to work with in a bit of a longer window of time.
I've been asked about my own experience to compare it to ayahuasca. And when I went to Gabon to do a Bwiti initiation, I had this perspective of the ayahuasca ceremony, which it was not that at all. But I feel like ayahuasca is more like this cosmic, expansive, otherworldly. It's also described as, and I experienced it as, more of a feminine presence and a feminine energy. Whereas Iboga for me was very much like going inward, going deep, going to the roots of things rather than into the cosmos. And I had an image that was consistent for me through my Iboga experience was like an old man with a kind of Tetris game-like sort of abacus and kind of like moving from the top of my head through my system, just like defragging or like doing these kind of like micro chiropractic adjustments in my actual physical system and revealing certain dreams or certain, as you say, childhood memories. That was a big thing for me. But it, this very long, arduous, meticulous process of a kind of old man doing these little adjustments was very much my experience. And I find it almost like diametrically opposite to my experience of ayahuasca, which is so expansive. You also did iboga in the context of an initiation. Can you share with us a little bit about what brought you to work with iboga in the first place and what that experience was like for you?
Well, my initiation was 5 years into working around Ibogaine already. So when I first came to it, I mean, I had had very healing experiences personally with psychedelics. So back in high school, I was put on antidepressants, mostly because I was pissed off. Coming off of those was the harder challenge. Like, it left me, I want to say, like, psychically scarred for a little while. Like, it was very difficult to sort of come back to a point where I guess the way to describe it, the way that we would call it in like the DSM, which I don't love, but in this case it sort of works, is depersonalization. Like, I didn't really feel like, often struggled with this sense of whether I was real or whether reality around me was real or how real it was or how continuous it was from one day to the next. And it was really challenging until I took mushrooms for the first time and had a really big emotional release and started to feel more like I was in my body and could feel like my own emotions. I could connect with people better. And that was really important for me and really impactful. And I'd already been interested in psychedelics. So anyways, it sort of put me more firmly on that path. And along the way, I started working with the Canadian Students for Sensible Drug Policy. So nobody was that interested in psychedelics at the time, but there was a lot of work around drug user rights and harm reduction. And at the time, I was in Canada. So the InSight, the supervised injection site in the downtown east side of Vancouver, was a big topic, and they were fighting for their right to exist. And so all of these topics brought our work and that organization in touch with all these issues. And being in Canada and interested in these things, I was also spending time around like Indigenous communities there, just like pipe ceremonies and sweat lodge and like red road practices. And so for me, iboga, and I think this happens for some people, it sort of became this very obvious intersection of all of these big sort of interests or pulls. And it sort of helped me realize how they all connected. And through my own experience with it later, it showed me that, well, actually, they just connect in my body. Like, this is me. This is the intersection right here. But iboga somehow related to and became like an important part of that path and showing me how to walk in all those ways at the same time. So that's what brought me around it in the first place.
You're describing at the moment, as I would understand it, a bit of a spiritual seeker approach to medicine, albeit after having this experience with antidepressants. A lot of folks head to iboga as a last stop with addiction, most especially opiate addiction. And maybe we can talk a bit about the aspects of iboga that are particularly efficacious for dealing with addiction. So did you approach iboga with any kind of a compulsive patterns that you wanted to reorganize through that medicine? Or was it more of a spiritual seeker? And then perhaps we can move on to talking about why iboga and the Bwiti tradition itself are helpful for dealing with addictive patterns.
Sure. Yeah. So like I took opiates one time when I broke my collarbone in high school. It was like took codeine. Like it wasn't a big part of my life, but I do relate with addictive patterns. And I think that didn't really become obvious to me until actually maybe iboga helped me realize where I was acting addictively. And Because maybe they were subtler things, like the consequences of those behaviors, and some didn't sort of accumulate until later in my life. I think sometimes in the process of forming an identity, we experiment with, you know, like the child that's experimenting, right? And I think one way of thinking about addiction is finding this thing in the world that sort of seems to meet our need. And then even as it becomes obvious that it's so disconnected from the real, like from what our fundamental needs are, we still stay stuck to this symbol and we sort of hold on to it for better or worse, for until it's life or death. And when people talk about eboga, they talk about going through this death. And it's, of course, a symbolic death. It's a death of a symbolic identity, and going back to this place of, well, now I don't necessarily know if I can tell the difference between the dream world and the real world, or at least they become the boundary between them becomes much more permeable. And I don't really know how to navigate through this or how to have my needs met, but certainly my needs during this time become much more basic when I need some help to sort of have them met, whether that's going to the bathroom or having a sip of water or whatever it is. I need some help with that. We get put back into this position. And so I almost felt like it was like looking in the mirror, going back in reverse, back in touch with the sort of sense that we have as an infant. And that's how in Bwitsi they do describe the initiatory process, is coming back to infancy. And over the days that follow, going back rapidly through these stages of maturation and development. And I think it can maybe give us an opportunity to sort of realign our identity in our symbolic world with something that's more in line with how can I like have my needs met? And I think on a felt level, it can give us the sense of actually being able to judge how something feels in our bodies. You know what I mean? Like being able to whatever, whether it's the food that we're eating or the choices that we're making or the thoughts that we're having, to be able to sort of have a better felt sense of how that sits with us, and still to have all the choice in the world. That's the absolute best way that I can think of to describe it. And I feel like the most universal one, because I don't think it matters if it's an opiate. So ibogaine has a sort of magical quality of reducing withdrawal from opiates at the same time. But much more fundamentally, I think that's the best way that I can describe what's going on.
So you spoke of the Bwiti initiation as kind of a regressing, and then the time thereafter being like a rapid rematuration. Something that you shared with me in our preparation for this podcast was around the idea that initiation is a beginning. That when we initiate, that this isn't a cure. And this is really interesting, I think, in the broader context of psychedelic medicine generally, and especially with iboga, and particularly with my own experience with iboga. My experience with iboga involved feeling pretty destabilized for a very long time afterwards. And whereas we talk about integration after, say, an ayahuasca experience, there's a period of time in which we take our lessons and kind of integrate them into our lives. With iboga, it, for me, felt a bit different than that. Rather than feeling like there was a big experience that needed integration, it felt as if there was an initiation into a long period of liminality, a long period of kind of not knowing. And yeah, I'd love to hear your philosophical perspective on iboga as initiation, and perhaps with your own experience after having done the initiation yourself.
Sure. Well, I mean, picking up on that same idea, like I felt like there was certain ways that in my life I'd built almost like a false identity. Some of those ways fairly concrete. There was ideas that I had about myself, and some of the ways were more subtle. Like I recognized, you know, ways that I was trying to like please people, not express myself fully. And afterwards, I kind of realized like some of those coping strategies that I'd had, like the sort of false identity that I'd built, felt false. And so I had to kind of drop it. And so the process afterwards wasn't necessarily an easy one. There was a couple of months where I felt amazing physically. You know, I felt charged. I felt like, I guess even like this sense of accomplishment. And maybe it was a kind of a bit of an ego boost. You know what I mean? Like that feeling, that sense of having overcome something challenging. And but after that, it was like this sort of peak, and then was followed by a period where it was challenging to figure things out. And I think it was coming back into a life where I had to sort of relearn who I was in a more authentic way. And that meant I had to learn how to communicate differently. I had to learn what my actual needs were in certain situations and choose to prioritize them over, you know, certain ways that I was making other people happy. And then to balance it out and be less of an asshole. But yeah, it was a renewed sense that I still had a lot to learn that was sort of just basic about being a person. It sort of accelerated the learning in some ways. But some of the bigger challenges that I went through in my life came about after that. And there was parts of it that sort of reflected back to the challenges that I had had when I was young. And it was like, now I have to be back here again and figure out how to navigate through this without just building up like a false identity or building up a coping strategy that's going to trip me up in the future. Like I got to sort of stay close to the ground and be more authentic with my approach now.
Can you describe the process from your initial interest in Ibogaine and Iboga work through your work convening the Global Ibogaine Therapy Alliance, creating the clinical guidelines for Ibogaine, and then ultimately SABO Recovery, which is your own process for aftercare coaching and support?
Yeah, so back in 2012, I started organizing conferences about Ibogaine, and through that process helped to organize an already existing community of practitioners into the Global Ibogaine Therapy Alliance, or at least to help formalize what was already there. And part of that formalization process was helping to develop the clinical guidelines for Ibogaine-assisted detox. So like at the time, there was two big challenges that the community was facing and would have to be dealt with as a group, right? Two major ones. So one of them was the safety issue. So there'd been a number of fatalities that had happened following people taking Ibogaine. And even in situations where there wasn't like mortality, there would be what we'd call in medical lingo morbidity. So other kinds of adverse events that sometimes led to hospitalizations and other kinds of complications. So we were trying to address mortality and morbidity. And so the clinical guidelines was the answer to that by just basically collecting all the information that we had about how to properly screen somebody for taking Ibogaine, how to monitor them going through it, how to respond with different kinds of interventions and different kinds of scenarios.
So Ibogaine and Iboga can be potentially lethal in that it can slow down the heart rate. And I think that it's not necessarily well known that as far as psychedelics are concerned, they're often considered non-lethal medicines, but Iboga actually can be a lethal experience.
Yeah, there's cardiac complications. There's other kinds of complications as well that you also wouldn't have with other psychedelics. For example, a lot of the classical psychedelics, LSD, psilocybin, DMT, they're working on a very narrow range of serotonin receptors. And Ibogaine's not. It's working on a lot of different things. One of those effects being that it's sensitizing the dopamine system, which is likely why people are not experiencing withdrawal, because their system's getting resensitized. So the tolerance to opioids would be dramatically lowered afterwards. You actually have to tell people if you use again afterwards, you have to use almost like you're opiate naive again. You certainly can't use at the level that you were right before the treatment, or you're at a higher risk for overdose. And so some of the complications were related with that or with other kinds of things, like benzo and alcohol withdrawal can lead to seizures, which can be a catalyst for cardiac events as well. So even if it's not a pre-existing heart condition, somebody that's going through benzo withdrawals, like from Valium or Xanax, and they're taking Ibogaine, can be at a higher risk for those kind of serious complications that might not otherwise have happened to them while they're going through benzo withdrawal, but Ibogaine lowers the threshold for the seizures to take place. So there's a number of different complications. And yeah, that's why the clinics that we work with here, that Saba works closely with a number of clinics. They're all medical facilities, so they're highly equipped. There's doctors and nurses and 24-hour medical care, and people are connected to cardiac monitors while they're going through the experience. And so we took the highest level of care that we wrote about in the guidelines, like highest risk management case. And that's how the sort of skeleton for how the programs at these clinics are structured.
So you were saying that one of the main reasons to convene these groups was around safety, and that's where the detox guidelines came from. What was the other main reason for convening around Iboga?
So the other big one that came up, actually, we were sort of convening because about the safety issues and just improving the community communication in general. The other one was the sustainability of how Iboga and Ibogaine are sourced. So I already mentioned that the Iboga, Tabernanthe Iboga, is coming from Gabon and a little bit the surrounding regions. It's a very small area. Gabon's a country of 1.5 million people. It's a tiny country and massive forest system. And the rainforest in the area is the second largest one behind the Amazon. But because of how it was being harvested and because of the fact that Gabon doesn't have a huge history of agriculture, you know, Iboga was just being harvested wild from the forest. And so for a long time, that was the primary source of Ibogaine. It's been a while now. There's been alternative sources as well. So a lot of the clinics that I work with here, they're using Ibogaine that's being produced semi-synthetically from Voacanga africana, which is a tree that grows in other parts of Africa and is produced agriculturally. So it's a renewable source. So they're extracting from that, they're extracting voacangine and then converting that into Ibogaine. So it results in a very, very pure, just Ibogaine hydrochloride. And so even still, I mean, there's people who prefer working with Iboga or full spectrum Iboga extracts or total alkaloid extracts. So there's still some issues around the sourcing, but when we were convening, that was one of the major ones. So sort of the fruition of that now is that there's an organization called Blessings of the Forest, and they've done an incredible job of throughout Gabon helping to equip villages that traditionally have been practicing Bwiti to farm and be able to potentially generate a livelihood from that. But they've been economically assisting them to do that. They've been providing tools and know-how. And so it's getting to the point now. So I've been the first person working closely enough with Blessings of the Forest to apply for an export license from Gabon. And we're waiting for the decision of the forest ministry on how that will look. So we're involved in negotiations. But anyways, so it's nice that over time we've made major progress on, if not solving, at least showing how these issues can be approached in like the healthiest ways possible.
So speaking of SEBA, you were just saying that SEBA works with a couple of different clinics. So SEBA itself is not a clinic. And you were talking about an export license out of Gabon. Mm-hmm. So are you working, personally, are you working with Iboga with clients at all? Or are you strictly in a kind of like aftercare coaching recovery program? Tell us a little bit about SEBA.
Sure. So SEBA has just been my personal practice for a couple of years and just helping people to prepare and helping. Yeah, we provide aftercare coaching and resources as well. So we do like free recovery groups for people who've been through Ibogaine treatment. We have a virtual intensive outpatient program, like an 8-week program for people who are going back home immediately and need some guidance and closer support. So that's mostly been how we're working. It's starting to grow a little bit. We've more recently been starting to offer more educational programs as well. So we worked with Ibando, which is a sort of cultural, like social healing space in Gabon. And we helped co-produce webinar series that was looking at Bwiti in depth and talking with Mimas. So, and again, they're like the initiators of the spiritual tradition holders from like different branches of Bwiti and going through that in depth. And we started offering training programs for people targeting psychologists and therapists who want to be able to support somebody who's going through the experience, clients or people who they're doing counseling with longer term, so they can understand the experience and what people are going through and some key ways that they can help support them. So we've started to branch into that kind of educational programming as well.
So with an eye to the fact that we have many psychedelic practitioners listening to the show, probably not that many who are actively involved in supporting someone going through an Ibogaine or Iboga experience. In a general sense, can you share a little bit with us some of what is offered in those educational materials? You say that you are specifically supporting therapists and other practitioners in understanding how to support Ibogaine aftercare. What are some of the ways that you do that? What are some of the suggestions you have for people?
Sure. I mean, one of the ways is by understanding sort of in depth what the treatment programs look like. And so I guess one of the cases might be somebody who's working with people who are in recovery and sort of understanding who's a good candidate and the kinds of things that people would need to do to be able to prepare to make use of that experience in the best way possible. So really to understand the experience and understand the way that the detox programs are structured would be like a big goal. The other one, a lot of what we do around the treatment is making sure that people have accurate expectations. We don't want people to assume that they're going to take this substance and whatever, they're just going to get through it. And then after that, they're going to be reset to a predictive state and go on with their lives. Especially when you're working with people like in long form like that with therapy over time, you need to be able to have a more nuanced understanding of what's going on for people. A lot of the time, like when I'm working with people who are about to take Ibogaine or who have just taken Ibogaine, it is putting it in the context of a bigger time frame. One good example is that's out there, that's sort of easy for people to look up and make use of is the stages of change model. That's part of the framework of smart recovery. I don't know if you've heard of smart recovery. It's based off of like motivational interviewing and cognitive behavioral therapy tools. So it's not a 12-step program. I don't think addiction is a cognitive problem, but after Ibogaine, it does feel like you have the choice back, where before your actions and your responses to things sort of felt automatic. By the time you thought of it, you're already doing it. So cognitive tools are maybe not the easiest place to start, but after Ibogaine, then yeah, the sometimes they are useful because you're just dealing with thoughts. So the stages of change model looks at, there's a point where we're in pre-contemplation about a change that we need to go through. Pre-contemplation meaning we're not really thinking that we even need to make a change or any aware of what that looks like. And then we go into this contemplation stage of recognizing what the problem is, contextualizing it, maybe what would it look like to not have this problem. And then we go into this planning stage afterwards. What are the actual steps that I need to take? Maybe what are the possible pathways here? And so that is something that you could take however long you need to get through. Sometimes people end up taking Ibogaine in the middle of this early part of this contemplation phase and still not having decided really to stop whatever they're doing, which is fine. But there's a point, the stages of change models looking at people who made long-term behavioral changes. So they quit smoking and they're 15 years later, not smoking anymore. They made a change. And they're saying that people who got there, at some point they went through an action phase that was 2 to 3 months of sort of more focused effort on replacement behaviors or building sort of a new kind of lifestyle or identity if you get to that level. And then after that, you go into a maintenance phase that can last 1 to 2 years. And so I always thought back to it like it was something like a good reference point, because it did feel to me like I felt this charge come over my life for several months. And then it was a couple of years of feeling different and just gradually making different choices over time. And, you know, there was a point probably 2 years later when I can look back to when I probably started to live in alignment with whatever change had happened. And now I was on my way with that. So anyways, there's certain tools that are sort of helpful reflection points like that. But I think that's a big part of what we support people with in Ibogaine, is sort of opening into this expansiveness of time that it brings us to. And like you said, it is, it's the beginning of something. And I think it's an incredible footing for a powerful change, but it is just like a starting point.
One of the things that I think comes up in psychedelic healing, particularly or maybe exclusively when we're talking about indigenous lineages and wisdom keepers, is that part of where ailments are coming from come from a worldview in the first place, and that the medicine may be in part having a physiological impact. I mean, we know that Ibogaine bonds with opioid receptors, for example. So there's a physiological impact. But there's also a kind of a collision of worldviews that can have its own healing power. So, for example, if you take ayahuasca in an indigenous context, you may find yourself compelled to have a greater respect for the earth itself and to change your relationship to the earth, feel more connected to the earth, and be more in alignment with the earth. And that is part of the healing. Whereas perhaps maybe you came because you had depression and an SSRI isn't really cutting it. Through the process of connection with this indigenous worldview, you see the disconnect you actually have and you're able to make that change. So how do you feel about iboga being separated from the indigenous context of the Bwiti perspective? I was thinking about this in part because you were just talking about the nature of time. The Bwiti have a very different perspective on time in terms of how slow time works, and the healing process in the context of Bwiti is this ongoing kind of process. Do you feel like ibogaine as an extraction offered for opiate addicts in Western clinical settings somehow loses part of what is so transformational about an initiation with the Bwiti in Gabon? What is lost there, in your opinion, having some understanding of both?
Well, I think that it is a different approach. I mean, even like I was describing earlier, the traditional perspective would point to a difference between a treatment and an initiation. Initiation being a sacrament on its own alongside whatever iboga is involved in that. And of course, I think that the clinical approach misses a lot of layers of what happens in an initiation, and that there's like a level of knowledge that doesn't carry through yet. A direct kind of understanding of how to navigate the experience and how to interact with the kinds of things that come up there. Regardless, I think that even when we're looking at just in the context of treatment and outside of a use that's that guided, I think people have incredibly transformative, incredibly important sort of spiritual experiences. But I had to sort of grapple with this, and I don't know if you did as well, but you know, being an outsider and going to Gabon for an initiation, it isn't the same. It isn't like a traditional approach, even to the sacraments of initiation. So I think a lot of times it would involve coming up in the village and being exposed to certain kinds of information and certain practices, certain visual and audio and other sensory cues that then are present in the initiation in a certain way and kind of activates them. We don't necessarily have them when we're coming from a different, totally different culture and a totally different worldview, which I think can still be, like you're saying, very transformative in and of itself. And so I do think that Iboga and Ibogaine on its own can be transformative, and the sacraments of initiation and having that collision of worldviews can also be transformative, but it's not necessarily going to be the most helpful thing for a lot of people, depending on where they're at in their life and kind of what they're going through. I think, you know, from my biography that I shared, you can see that I was like looking for that. But I think other people are looking for something different, and I can understand why it might be almost like adding levels of confusion or challenge to the experience to be in that kind of setting.
Yeah, I actually approached Iboga in part through the lens of rites of passage. It was a time in my life where I was studying a lot around masculinity in the Western world and the lack of rites of passage for young men, and how in certain traditional societies, these experiences that allow a boy to become a man were woven into the culture in a way that we don't have. And so in addition to my own addictive patterns, not opiates, but compulsive behaviors that I was wanting to address with Iboga, part of why I did it was around this idea, like, I want to experience a potentially lethal initiation, because there's something about the lethality of it. To be properly afraid of death is part of these kind of traditional initiations that I had been studying, and I wanted to do that. One of the things that I found was that in a traditional initiation, it's held within the container of the village, within a community. Mm-hmm. And so you go into the initiation as a boy, you go through a series of experiences, and not only do you understand that you have changed because of the experiences, the community or village understands that you've changed because you've gotten through the challenge of this experience. So you're received by a community who sees you for the first time as a man and no longer a boy. And therefore, you are more able to step into this new role because of what is expected from you by the community. When we look at healing in the Western context, particularly healing from addiction, one of the things that's most challenging for many people is the fact that they go and have this huge transformative experience. And if they go back into the conditions of their environment that were facilitating these behaviors with these same people in these same conditions, they're so much more likely to return to those behaviors versus if you are, you know, held by community. And I think one of the things that's most challenging in terms of psychedelic medicine taken out of an indigenous context is the fact that we really don't have an integration into a community that really understands the experiences that we've been through and what they mean. It was certainly my case in doing my Iboga initiation with the Bwiti. There wasn't any sort of like integration protocols. I just sort of went in, had the experience, and it was very big and very challenging. And then just in a sense carried on with my life. And you spoke about feeling a destabilization. And this is, you know, to be a little more personal on this podcast, I've felt a sense of destabilization for 3 years having done that on the very themes that came up in the dream state itself. And to, you know, take advantage of this opportunity on a personal level in speaking to you, I'm interested in your experience in coaching individuals who've gone through these kinds of big Iboga or Ibogaine experiences. How does one, going through an initiatory experience and then entering into some degree of a liminal state where the pot is stirred, the issues are kind of raised to the surface, and then that lasts for a while, has happened for me, and I think it can happen for many people. What is the appropriate way to then bring a patient through the other side of that period? Is it simply a matter of it lasts as long as it lasts and you kind of like run the clock on it and you're destabilized for a certain time, but at a certain point you come back to baseline or come into a new way of being? Is it best to, say, facilitate someone through a potentially long process of initiation or liminality? Or is it just a matter of letting it unfold in a kind of trusting the natural healer kind of way?
Yeah, I think in terms of coaching, I think it's good to, again, just point to the time frame that it takes for things like this to unfold. And it makes sense, do you know what I mean? That you've been through the sense of feeling destabilized afterwards, and that might be part of the process. When we go through initiation, it is to kind of realize ultimately that it's a sort of a sense of responsibility that we have for our own life. And I think that's one thing that you get to see in a village context is a lot of people who have somehow or another done it. You have models, right, to work with. I think that is maybe something that we still lack. Like that's not something that we can simply import, because the models in a small African village are not necessarily people who have integrated around the same kinds of challenges that you're going through. I mean, some of them, for sure. I mean, some of them are universal to being a human, and others of them aren't, because they're going to be specific to your cultural context and your background will be different. Those are significant issues. So I don't know. I mean, I can just say for me, being on the sort of cutting edge of recovery spaces, I never really saw myself going back into 12-step programs. They seemed played out and tried, and they didn't work. But I started to realize after feeling destabilized that how important it was for me to be able to lean back into these traditions and take from them what was valuable from them. You know what I mean? Like, it wasn't just to look to the tradition of Bwiti, although there was a lot there about using Iboga that was really valuable. And there was a lot there that was universal. There was a lot of things that I needed to look to other traditions that were more immediately present for me that I could easily build some kind of understanding or community through. So, yeah, I don't know if that's helpful. I do think it's a process. I think when we're supporting people going through, there's just a certain level of accompaniment that we can provide. And I think it's helpful having been through that or been through something similar, sort of grappled with at least that kind of thing, and I've had to be challenged and learn and grow. And some people do find more or less that the medicine is offering guidance and sort of making it easier. But then there's those of us like yourself and myself both, I think we've been able to experience that too, where maybe it's also at some point sort of pushes us to explore and find some other inner resources or some other kind of resource or tradition to sort of look to.
I think that maybe part of the idea of liminality itself is that there aren't really exactly answers to the questions. And that, as Rilke suggests, we must learn to love the questions themselves, which I am trying to do. Well, John, we're getting to the end of our time together today. And I always like to end this podcast giving my guest the opportunity to speak directly to psychedelic practitioners and healers and those who aspire to be, who are listening to this show, whether they maybe have a desire to support addiction recovery or spiritual exploration through iboga or perhaps a different medicine, or those who are just interested. What might you say to those who are involved in the facilitation of psychedelic healing, particularly after spending so much time yourself in that role?
Sure. Well, I mean, I guess, you know, what I know a little bit more about is iboga and ibogaine. And I would say that it's something that really does, you know, play out over a long time. And I think that there can be sometimes a sort of sense of urgency that people feel to move towards it, especially depending on people's life situation. And people are looking for a detox option and stuff. And it's something that we approach so infrequently in our lives because it's such a powerful thing. And it starts such a powerful movement in our life that sometimes feels subtle or whatever, but nonetheless, very, very profound and very deep. So around iboga, I think it's good just to go slow, take your time and be deliberate and give it a lot of space and room to breathe. I think you're doing a good thing, sort of reaching out and looking for community and sharing perspectives and things. So if you know anybody else who's doing that, then we're happy to connect with them at Seba. And we do have a weekly recovery group every Wednesday evening. That's just for people who've been through ibogaine and are doing some kind of addiction recovery themselves. So I think it's a nice space. And I think it is important that we find ways to communicate and share our perspectives. I think it's valuable.
You know, when people ask me whether they should do iboga, which people seem to ask me a lot, be like, should I do iboga? I say categorically no. So you should not do iboga. Unless you must do iboga, in which case you must do iboga. But in the kind of like spiritual marketplace buffet of experiences, I don't think that that's what iboga is for. I don't think it's something to check off a list of kind of peak psychedelic states to have experienced in one's life. I think it's really something to be approached very mindfully, because as we've discussed through this whole episode, it is potentially the initiation of a long process, one which may be bewildering at times. You were just mentioning Seba and connecting. How can people connect with Seba, connect with you? You were just suggesting this weekly group. Where can people find you? And we'll put all of this in the show notes.
So sebaibogaine.com is the website, and you can find everything on there. There's a, you know, way to sign up for the mailing list for the meetings. There's the educational programs we were talking about, the weekly webinar, all these things you can find on the website.
Awesome. Well, we'll have that in the show notes. And Jonathan, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. And also our previous conversation was helpful as well for my own journey. I appreciate you being open about yours and offering so much through Seba and through your long experience with this medicine. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thanks, Eamon. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please join the Psychedelic Therapy Facebook group to talk about it. You can also share it with your friends or leave a review on iTunes so more people can discover the show. The Psychedelic Therapy Podcast is presented by Maya, a platform designed to help psychedelic therapists manage and measure client journeys. You can head to mayahealth.com to learn more. The show is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide mental health or medical advice. Thanks for listening.